This is a tape of a Narcotics Anonymous speaker in Porterville, California on November 18, 1989. The speaker is Gene R. from Modesto, California. Please respect the anonymity of all NA speakers. This tape is recorded by Choices Tape, Post Office Box 367, Visalia, California, area code 209-738-9447.
Our speaker for tonight, he's the RSR of our region. That's Gene R. from Modesto.
Where's everybody going? My name is Gene and I'm an addict.
Hi, Gene.
To start this off, I hope you bear with me for just a minute. There is a man in Northern California who served in the same capacity that I did, and he died on Monday. So what I'd like to ask real quick is just a brief moment of silence for Rick Haas. Thank you. And it'll take me a few minutes to get going here because my heart jumps up in my chest. The gentleman came up to me and asked, you know, gee, I'm going to record you and I hope that's okay with you. And my thought was, I hope you hear more than just a heartbeat. I usually start my pitches with, I have a real soft spot in my heart for those of us that have been like in and out and in and out of this fellowship and that try to grab on to recovery around here. And what I usually do and I'm going to do today is that there's a few friends of mine, I'm a transplant from Southern California, and there's a few friends of mine that didn't make it here. When I was in junior high, me and a friend of mine, Dave, we used to take a lot of reds together. Dave just decided that, he wanted to take a whole bunch and he wanted to check out. And he's no longer with us. There's another guy by the name of Brian, and Brian and I used to laugh because one day, we were shooting dope and, he ran into a backhoe that was parked on the street and, he ended up being in the hospital, and we used to laugh, when the IV would turn brown, when we'd shoot dope into the IV. And Brian overdosed, and Brian's no longer with us. I was waiting one day, and this is, just before I got clean this time. Me and a friend of mine were waiting for Bob to come back from Los Angeles, from downtown, and he never showed up. He went down to cop, and he overdosed, and after a few hours, we knew where he was at. All we had to do was just call the morgue, and there he was. It was like 4 hours later. I had a music store at one time, and I had overdosed in that music store, and Bob was just somebody that I used with, and there were times, or there was a time when I overdosed in that store, and there were times when Bob had burned me and I had burned Bob, and it was one of those kind of things. And but when I overdosed that day, he picked me up off the floor and put me in my truck, and he drove me home and locked up the store for me, and it's just one of those things that when we're there, when we're down and out, I think we all know that, at some level. He didn't burn me that day. And I share those things to sort of remind myself of why we're here and why I'm here, and by all rights shouldn't be. And I think it's that way for a lot of us. I'm going to try to... I don't know. What I'll probably do is talk about what's happening recently and then back up and then maybe come back around again. I don't know. I had no idea what I was going to say before I got up here, and you know, I just hope to be on. You know, I had mentioned Rick, you know, it kind of stunned me because I just found out yesterday, you know, and he died on Monday, and, you know, he died from a heart attack and died clean. And death has been like something that I've been talking about recently. You know, during my active addiction and even, you know, efforts at recovery, I was in this long-term recovery house once, and you know, I had gone in there, and I'd been there for about 3 or 4 months, and I was like trying to make, you know, some kind of connection, build some kind of bridge with my folks. And so I had like written some letters to my mom and to my dad, and they lived in Northern California, and I was in Southern California at the time. And you know, I'd written my mom some letters and my dad some letters, and as far as my mom was concerned, you know, it was like the door was shut. You know, because basically I'd been like a bull in a china shop through her life and everybody else's. And there wasn't anything, you know, to build on. Because I had just, you know, burned the bridge a lot. And when I cleaned up this time, you know, I had, you know, first of all, you know, my mom's, you know, she's got this disease. And, you know, I was one of those people who was like on fire with the program and everybody needed to get clean and, you know, go out and impose recovery on everybody. And so, you know, I decided that I was going to do that with my mom, and, you know, every time I tried to do that, you know, I'd lead with my chin, and, you know, I'd be putting my nose in places that didn't belong, and, you know, I ended up, you know, giving her a book on recovery and a meeting directory, and, you know, just had to let it go. And I was about a year and a half, I don't know, something like that, maybe 20 months clean. And I, you know, I think she sent me back the book shredded, you know, telling me where I could insert it or something, I don't know. But, you know, I had tried, you know, and you know, what I'd learned around here is that, you know, I need to, like, mind my own business and work on me. And, you know, what she does is her own business. And made some decisions that, you know, that I wasn't going to get anything from that relationship, and, you know, I just needed to leave it alone. And, you know, probably a year later than that, you know, she went in for surgery, you know, and had a mastectomy, because, you know, not uncommon, you know, got cancer, and, you know, had this surgery, this is about 2 years ago, and, you know, When she had that surgery, it was like, you know, my head told me, well, you know, she had the surgery, it's over, it's done, you know, she's going to get better now, and that kind of thing. And I got a call about 3 months ago. Forgive me if I get emotional here. I got a call about 3 months ago, and, you know, she had this massive tumor, you know, that's like, you know, all through her body. And you know what what's happening is that she's dying, you know. You know, I made a decision at that point that, you know, I needed to get off of what I'd been hanging on to, and that basically was my resentments, because, you know, she wasn't doing what I wanted her to do. So, you know, I went up there and talked to her, and I sat down, and I said, you know, I've been trying for, you know, 4.5 years now to try to build a relationship, and every time I do, you know, it's like I get frustrated and I lead with my chin, and, you know, I get angry and I've just thrown my hands up. And she looks at me and says, yeah, so did I. And, you know, from that kind of straightforward conversation, you know, and obviously, you know, her stubbornness and my perseverance, we started to develop a relationship, you know, out of this disease, you know. And disease is disease, you know. And what's happened since then, you know, is that we've started to build a bridge between the two of us, and that, you know, I've started to feel like that relationship is beginning to it's just really flourished in the last few months. And, you know, I was up there visiting her last week. And, you know, she ain't looking so good and, got no hair, no eyebrows, and we've been able to talk openly, you know, about death, and, you know, she's been worried about, you know, gee, what's going to happen with my house and all of that stuff. And, I, you know, I heard this somewhere, and I told her, you know, the best will I've ever heard is being of sound mind. I spent it, you know. What happened last week was that, you know, she's in that process of saying goodbye, I think. Because, you know, she gave me some coins. She gave me these 10 gold coins. That, not gold, but silver coins that were given to her when I was born. And she gave me some tie clips, you know, that were her father's who died from this disease. I never knew him. And, you know, the beauty of Narcotics Anonymous and the beauty of the steps and the beauty of what's happening around here is that, you know, she doesn't have to know, she doesn't have to remember this dope fiend being out there on the streets who is using and is burning everybody, including her and anybody that came in my path. That's a gift that Narcotics Anonymous has given me. The other thing is that we've been able to share on a real neat level about commitment to recovery, and that her commitment to doing what she needs to do to recover from this disease, cancer, is the same commitment that I've made to, you know, recover from this disease. And it's like, you know, both of them are sort of we concepts. And that's really neat, you know, to be able to share that, to be able to build that bridge. I come from Southern California, and I was raised in Burbank, you know, beautiful downtown Burbank. And, you know, I was basically raised in, like, you know, middle-class kind of neighborhood and that kind of thing, and, you know, me and consequences never really did good. You know, me and consequences really never met eye to eye. My idea about consequences was, you know, even if they have pictures, deny what's happening. You know, and run, you know, run quick. You know, and that started before I ever took my first drug. You know, I would, you know, it's like every parent's worst nightmare. So it's like, you know, I'd go to school and I, you know, second grade, third grade, I'd get in trouble. And, you know, it was at one point that, you know, it's like the school was sending reports home every week about what I was doing and what I wasn't doing. And there was like this standardized form with yeses and nos on it. And you know, each time that, you know, at the end of every week, you know, almost invariably, you know, I got some kind of derogatory comment that I did something wrong. And, you know, I was, even, and, you know, at that point in time, I had also learned, you know, it's like I needed the acceptance of about, you know, probably 8,000 people. You know, it's like real broad. So, you know, I lived about 12 blocks from my house to elementary school, and on the way there, I would, like, you know, bebop through little shopkeepers' places and say hello and, you know, get to know folks and that kind of thing. And, you know, every time I brought one of these reports home, I had to, like, get it signed by, you know, my dad. So, you know, it's like I got the idea, you know. First of all, I'd bring home these reports, and if I got derogatory comments, my first reaction to that was, like, you know, injure myself to avoid some kind of consequence. You know, so I'd, like, take a knife to myself or that kind of thing. You know, basically what I was trying to do is dodge. And the other thing is that on my way home from school, you know, it's like I would stop in these little shopkeepers and say, hey, you know, I got this little form and, you know, it's supposed to have an adult signature on it, and would you like to sign this? So, you know, I tried doing those kinds of things, you know, and this is like before I ever took my first drug. I took my, you know, I think I had my first drug when I was 8, And my, you know, and that experience is not unlike other experiences that I've heard around here. And what that was about was, you know, some champagne and on a New Year's Eve, and my mom had given me some and given my brother some, and you know, it's like as soon as I drank it and as soon as I started to feel it, you know, I started to feel warm and I started to feel good, and you know, I liked it. My reaction was different than my brother's. You know, my brother like started to feel it and went to bed. And I started to feel it and stayed up and like paced around the room and, you know, just wanted to enjoy that. And then I, you know, basically, you know, I really didn't start using like on a regular basis until, you know, sixth grade, fifth grade, somewhere in there. And I just went through the usual gambit of drugs that, you know, that a lot of us go through. And you know, just a little bit of that about that, a little bit about the kind of thinking that I had and the kinds of things that I did, and you know, I always, you know, it's like when you're self-centered, you know, you're always like the last to know, you know, and, you know, especially when you think you're slick and you know other people have been aware for years. I you know, for example, you know, I was working in Southern California and I was hanging drywall tape, and I would like, you know, I'd show up loaded, you know, at 6 a.m. And I got to thinking, you know, which is a dangerous thing for any addict. And I got to thinking, you know, I'm like the best, you know, taper that this company's ever seen. And as a matter of fact, they've never had it so good to have a guy like me on the job. So I decided that I'm going to go down, as a matter of fact, I'm going to tell the foreman that I am the best guy here, and as a matter of fact, I deserve a raise. So so I went downstairs and, you know, went down to the trailer on the site and knocked on the door, went in, said, "Where's the foreman?" And the secretary said, you know, "Well, he'll be back in 10 minutes. And I said, "Okay, fine, I'll sit down and wait." And within a few seconds, I nodded off and passed out. and what happened was the guy, I woke up, I guess it was, I don't know, sometime later, and those three or four guys standing around me laughing. And, you know, I went down there for a raise, and I ended up getting my severance check. You know, thank you very much. But, you know, that's the kind of thinking that I had. You know, that naturally, you know, no one realizes my potential and what a warm and wonderful human being I am. What happened was, you know, that I got strung out and you know, somewhere about 1982, late 1982 or 83, early 83, after, you know, like being strung out, you know, it's amazing when, you know, when you're strung out and you don't know it, and it's like you quit using it, it's like, wow, I got a real bad cold, and not really being hip to what's going on, and, anyway, what ended up happening was I went into my first program, and, you know, it was, well, I think I was there for about 9 days, and a group of us sat around the table, you know, talking about how good using was, and we, you know, romanced ourselves right out the door, and about four of us went out and shot dope again, you know, 9 days later. I ended up coming back into that program, this time, you know, a little bit more serious, a little bit more devastated. And it was then that I had my my first exposure to Narcotics Anonymous. And some very key and essential things happened, you know. I was talking with somebody before the meeting about simplicity, and about, you know, just real simple, basic stuff. And I was sitting in this meeting, and you know, I'm the kind of guy who, like, presents, even, you know, even in recovery, you know, I will present myself as being, like, you know, self-assured and confident and, you know, I don't need anybody and, you know, that kind of thing. you know, the truth of the matter is that inwardly I'm really kind of scared and insecure and don't know what to say, don't know how to act, and, you know, that kind of thing. But I wasn't going to let you know that. So I was sitting in this meeting, and it was an H&I panel. It was a Narcotics Anonymous H&I panel in this detox. And I'm sitting there, and I'm all indignant. You know, what's this Narcotics Anonymous all about? What do I got to do? How many meetings do I got to go to? How long do I got to go to meetings for? You know, really just shooting off a battery of questions. And I asked, how long do I got to go to meetings? And do I have to do this? You know, what's this all about? In a more aggressive tone. And this woman, sat there and she looked at me and, she had these real thick Coke bottle glasses on. And she looked like she wouldn't say shit if she had a mouthful. And she looks at me, real straight and basically says, you don't have to go to meetings for the rest of your life. You only have to go to meetings for as long as you want to stay clean. Now, it really didn't have the impact that it has to me now, at that time. Clearly, she didn't understand my situation. the point of all of that is that, after like a whole bunch of treatment programs later, like eight of them, what I remembered was that message. Was a real simple, straightforward Narcotics Anonymous message. Some of the things that happen, it's like I go in and I get remorseful for a while and I do the, never again and, that trip and then I'd leave and I'd go out and get loaded. Many times I wouldn't even, I'd make it up. I'd leave the treatment program and I'd go directly to the connection. One time in a long-term treatment program, it's like I had one of those, one of those recovery house romances. I was in there for, about 6 or 7 months. And, it was all about grudge sex. And, what happened was, here I am. I'm in the throes of addiction. I got arrested on like the 18th of August. I got bailed out, on the 19th of August, just in time to make my wedding rehearsal. Something was basically wrong there in that situation. And we decided at that point that we couldn't call the wedding off because the invitations were already out. I got married on the 20th, and then, September 8th, I went into this long-term treatment program. Somewhere around, February, I'm talking to her on the phone, and she's saying, I'm getting a little tired of waiting. And I naturally got indignant and, once again told her she didn't know how good she had it to have me in her life. What happened was I went and had grudge sex at her, with one of the ladies in the house, and I never cop to anything, once again, even if they have pictures, deny it, I didn't do it, it must have been someone else, I denied all of that, and I got out, and, it's like I'd be with my wife, and, I'd be around her and I'd feel about 3 or 4 inches tall and just really couldn't stand myself. And after like, 10 months of group every day and, hardcore, it was a Synanon-based treatment program. And getting my head shaved and, all of those things. 3 weeks later after I was out of that program, it's like I was right back into the spoon. So what happened, and I forget where I was going with that, but oh well, see, recovery gets good. What happened was, it's like I had gone through that program and several others after that. Somewhere around May the 15th, something like that, May 16th, I don't know, 1985, I had blown out of a treatment program. Once again, there I was. It's like they really got tired of seeing me coming. you know, oh no, here he comes again. I'd sit there and you know, I'd cry, you know, and say, oh, I don't want to be here, and you know, and my life is miserable, and So I blew out of there, you know, went directly to the connection, went home. She had always said, you know, it's time for you to go. And, you know, my reaction to that had been, well, you know, I'm not leaving. One Friday morning she'd said, you know, you need to go. And this time it felt and sounded more serious. I was like going in and out of a blackout and, you know, as living that double life. Because by day, you know, it's like I was living in Studio City. I think by night, during sleeping hours anyway. I was living in Studio City and you know, as soon as like she would take off for work, because, you know, it's by then I couldn't keep a job. You know, the only thing I had going was a little hustle. So as soon as like she'd take off for work, I'd be, boom, in the car, you know, down to MacArthur Park in Los Angeles, hanging out for Johnny Cadillac, waiting, you know, and doing my thing down there, zip home before she got home, you know, doing that whole trip. Quite the romance. So she had said, you know, you need to go. And it felt a little more serious that time. And, you know, later that afternoon, at noontime, I think I called her at lunch and said, you know, did you say I needed to go? And she said, yes. And I said, well, once again, I'm not going. And what she did was, you know, she called some friends of mine that I had been through treatment with. They came over, packed up my stuff, packed me up with it, and sent me on the way. I proceeded to, you know, burglarize a lot of her stuff, Quentin Ponder camera and, you know, a bunch of other things. I'll show her. It's interesting. It's sort of like, well, as soon as she got the restraining orders, I told her it was over. I leave there and Monday, this was on a Friday afternoon. Monday morning about 7 a.m., somewhere around there, I woke up in Modesto. I had basically, you know, lost 3 days and really didn't know how I got there or what happened. It turns out, you know, it's like I picked up a hitchhiker and, you know, I said, I can't drive and you drive. And, miracle that I'm here. Anyway, I woke up there and I had no idea I was going to get clean. I had no idea that I was going to get clean this time. What happened for me, this was about May the 20th, was I went to my brother's house and, you know, I kicked on his couch. And, you know, I miserabled at his house for about 10 days. And it was like one of the worst detoxes I had ever been through. You know, it was all about vomiting and defecating at the same time for days on end. And, you know, it's like I got to the point where, you know, it's just real ugly. I had to wear a diaper, you know. And I, you know, sometimes jokingly say when you do that, you know, and you vomit and defecate at the same time, what it teaches you is how to make split-second decisions. You know, it's like you got to guess right. You're cleaning. You know, I detoxed on my brother's couch. And I went up to San Francisco, which is where my mom lives. And I felt like the most lonely and most depressed person ever. That if you would have looked up depression in the dictionary, you would have found my picture. And I went up to my mom's house, and it always been one of those situations where, you know, when my life was in the shitter, you know, it's like then somebody would come to the rescue. You know what? I didn't want to be rescued this time. And I basically told, you know, my mom and, you know, what I thought about that and what I thought of her. and my dad. And what happened for me was, as soon as I like unloaded and as soon as I took some personal responsibility for my life, I went to a meeting that night in Daly City. And what happened for me was a spiritual awakening. And that spiritual awakening came in the form of that it's going to be okay, that I'm going to be okay, and that the obsession was removed. That there was a real sense of peace amidst I didn't have anything, you know. I didn't have anything to my name. I had this beat up pickup truck and $11. And, you know, that's where I started. But God had graced me with this touch that I'm to this day really, really grateful for. I'm really, really grateful for relief from that desperation. And you know what? I got a sense of what it was like to stay in the day and stay in the now. And all I need to do is what's just directly in front of me. And that's all I need to worry about. Which is really, really peaceful. And it's really super. The things that I didn't lose, I decided that, whatever, was part of the image, you know. Part of that image I already talked about. You know, it's like, you know, I came to the fellowship well adjusted and I caught your insanity, you know, that kind of image. So what happened was that, you know, I had like 10 days clean. And I say this because I know there's somebody out there. And I decided to disregard a few of my relapses. And so I had 10 days clean and said I had 18 months clean. My belief at the time, you know, it's just bold-faced lie about my clean time. My belief at the time was that in order to be someone in Narcotics Anonymous, that I needed to have some time around here, which is, you know, it's just not true. It's just something I made up. But I just went with the lie. So I moved to Modesto, and I set up camp there. And, you know, I begin to, you know, promote this lie or keep this lie going. It's all about image and it's all about looking good and all of that stuff. So I start telling folks, you know, in Modesto, you know, hey, I've got 18 months and, you know, and da 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 da, and I'm, you know, in with the fellas, you know. And, you know, I start getting involved in, you know, the things that are happening in Narcotics Anonymous. And, you know, at the time there were like 3 meetings a week. And, you know, we're involved with, you know, starting to develop things around there. And, you know, I'm, you know, basically full of crap. So, you know, I started, you know, I'm carrying this deal, this lie, which, you know, incidentally is real uncomfortable. Because... Here I am in Northern California, go to Northern California conventions, you know, and there'd be all my friends from Northern California, and some friends from Southern California would show up, you know, and it's like, you know, I'm just, you know, one of the fellas, you know, with my friends from Northern California, but, you know, people from Southern California are surprised to see I'm still alive, you know, so it's like trying to do this dance and maintain this lie and, you know, a lot of work. Kept me busy anyway. I got a job. Actually, you know, we talk about not making any major changes in our, you know, first year of recovery. I had 6 jobs in my first 90 days. I think part of the deal was that I wasn't real employable. But anyhow, you know, in the meantime, I had talked to my wife on the phone, and she had said, she asked me about this recovery house romance, and I had always denied it. And I learned something about, you know, this responsibility thing. You know, there's a statement in Why Are We Here about that. You know, through our inability to accept personal responsibility, we were actually creating our own problems. So she had asked me about this recovery house romance, and I had always denied it. And this time I said, yeah, it happened. And here's why it happened. And you know what, if you want to come up here and be, you know, with me for this, you know, that's great. You know, these are the things that I'm going to do. I'm going to go to meetings and, you know, I'm going to hang around in recovery and, you know, I'm going to do all of those things. If you want to be here, that's great. And if you don't want to be here, that's great too. But you need to make a decision based on whatever it is you need to do. So, I began to experience that little sense of freedom. I think I was about 4 months clean, landed a job, you know, a nice job. And she had moved up. She decided she wanted to be around. 9 months and 10 seconds later, my son was born. You know, it's sort of like we get clean and it's,
wow.
So I get this little job and we get this little apartment and we move from this little apartment to this nicer townhouse, and then it's like we were able to buy a new car, and for this addict, I always bought $300 cars. You scotch tape them back together. When they die, you just sort of sneak away and leave them there. So for this addict, buying a new car, once again, what's on the outside. So there we were in this nice townhouse, and then we got a dog, and then my son was born. Then we moved from there to, we got the 3-bedroom house, and we had the second car, and a new car, and the dog, and the son, and on the outside, things were looking super. On the inside, I was dying. I had heard a guy by the name of Doug F. in Southern California, and I was going in and out, and this guy had, about 6-7 years clean, at the time, and, driving a brand new Cadillac and wearing, brand new clothes and jewelry and all of this stuff, talking about he didn't want a thing he had. And I was down and out and miserable. I had duct tape holding my shoes together. And I didn't understand that. And there I was 2.5 years clean, saying, you know what, I don't want a thing I got. What happened was is that, I started to work these steps, and I did an inventory, and I shared my fifth step, and started to work on my sixth step and seventh step, and primarily worked on greed, and envy, and things that were outside of me and looking good and that kind of crap. I was in this job, and this job basically was really demanding, and they paid me super, but I didn't have a life, and came to believe that I was basically just selling myself, working, a whole lot of hours in a day, and, it just wasn't worth it. And I carried that lie about my clean time for 2 years. And I was working the steps, and I worked the sixth and the seventh, and I'd written a list and an eighth step, and I stood in on the ninth step, beautiful step. 6, 7, 8, and 9 are really, really freeing steps. What happened was is that where I was working, I maintained this lie and decided, in our basic text it tells us that when we were dishonest with people, that we needed to make amends. And I had been dishonest with the entire fellowship. And I had been dishonest with everybody. And my fears of insecurity and rejection and I'm not good enough and if you knew who I was and all of that stuff were just like roaring. Years clean. As a matter of fact, it was that day. And you people accepted me. No questions asked. It's like that image that I thought I needed to carry. and that fear kept distance between me and you. And I was missing out on a lot of things this fellowship had to offer. And what came about out of that ninth step as well is that, I had had a three-year medallion in my pocket for 3 years. And what came out of working those steps was I was able to realize that three-year medallion. And I had never taken a chip, and at least an honest one. One of the most beautiful experiences that I've had in recovery was the birth of my son. I never finished that. Excuse me, I fragment here, so I'll come back to the main theme here in a minute. What came out of that ninth step was that I realized that I had made a decision that I needed to be with my wife because, we lived for 2 years, we were married for 2 years during my active addiction, and that I owed her that time, in recovery because, I owed it to her. At least that's what I thought. And out of that ninth step came the understanding that as long as I was paying on that debt, I was only paying interest, and I was never paying on the principal, which was me. And what happened out of that was that it freed me up to not have to have all of that outside stuff. And I went from having all of that outside stuff I came back from the World Convention in 1987 in New Orleans and, decided that this was over. And ended up with the second car and not the house and all the bills and a roommate, and it was, really free. Really, really free. Getting back to the birth of my son. On the July the 10th, we went to the hospital and my wife was about, 8-9 days overdue, something like that. So we had been through Lamaze and we had been through all that stuff and, we were into breathing. I was into it. So we show up at the hospital. They're going to induce labor. So they start inducing labor 7 o'clock in the morning. They're giving her pit all day long. And it's she went half to one, no action. And I'm just into it. I'm into this breathing thing. At one point I hyperventilated. I'm into it more than she is. No action. Next day, same action. It's one of the few times I was ever on time. Showed up at 6:30. We're inducing labor. Around about 3:30 in the afternoon, she's telling the doc, I'm done. I'm not going to do this, no action, just send me home, never mind. So the doctor comes in and she's got an IV in her, he hits her up, and it's the first thing she says is, am I supposed to feel tingly all over? And my mind immediately goes to morphine sulfate, I know that feeling, So I get all anxious, I leave the room, I go out, I smoke a cigarette, and I figure, this is my chance, this is it. I'm going to flip it back on her. So I go in there and I tell her, I look at her and I say, your eyes are pinned. She doesn't want to leave. She goes, what? I'm just real tired. This is the shit I used to run on her. Then she gets this big grin on her face and looks at me and says, how's it feel? I shrink about 3 feet. So that night, we have a step study in Modesto, and that Friday night I went to that step study and I shared with the group what was happening, and I had asked everybody to pray for us. And it was real clear to me that you people prayed for us, because my son was born the next afternoon at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, 2/12, July the 12th. And it just happened to be on our area Unity Day. It was probably one of the most beautiful experiences that I had in my recovery so far. The experience of seeing a life, seeing his life, It's just absolutely beautiful. I don't know if there are words to describe it, but it just like came over me. And once again, that's a gift that Narcotics Anonymous has given me. Because I, by all rights, should not have been there. You know what? I should have been down at Chewy's house. I should have been waiting for Johnny Cadillac down at MacArthur Park on 5th and Alvarado in Los Angeles. Because that's where I was coming from. And I just had no rights to be there. I want to cover, you know, just like a couple of more things. How much time do I got? I know Dana was telling me, you know, keep it. How much time do I have? I have 10 minutes? Okay. I, you know, it's like I tend to run at the mouth and I missed an area service committee meeting, and they're usually about 4 hours long, and I didn't show up one day, and the meeting was like an hour and a half, you know. I want to talk a little bit about God. And you know, what's keeping me around here, and I want to talk a little bit about my relationship with my son, and how the steps have helped me to do that. I adopted a concept. I come from a place of you know, I'm a recovering Catholic. I went to that school of Our Lady of Brewer on the Knuckle, you know, and you know, it's sad. To this day, sometimes when I drive by a Catholic church, I can feel the guilt. you know, I adopted this concept that I had heard a guy in this fellowship pitch, and you know, it's just a really neat concept about God and about how this works for me. You know, I again, I'm coming from a place where I thought that God was going to punish me and that I was going to burn and all of that stuff, and that you know, that our traditions talk about a loving God. This God that I've come to understand is like the relationship. My relationship with God today is sort of like a relationship of father-son. And that relation, that father-son relationship, is just like the relationship with my son. So what I believe is that I've never brought pain to my son so he could learn how to deal with a situation in his life. You know, I never like bring a situation so you know, he can learn how to grow. I don't believe that, and I've never done it to my son. What how that relationship works with my son is that, you know, he's three, and he comes up to me and he gets a hug and he gets his little charge, and then he goes out and he does this thing, you know, and he plays and whatever, and after about 30-40 minutes he starts looking around, where'd Dad go? And then, you know, it's like he turns around and comes back and he gets his little hug and his charge and he goes out again. You know, it's like my relationship with God is the same way. You know, it's like I go through life and I bump and grind my way. It's sort of like that car, Christine, you know. You know, I go out into life and I break my windshield and my paint and, you know, my fenders get dented and all that stuff, and I come back and get that hug and charge from God and get my paint job and new windshield and go out there and do it again. And you know what? That God is always there and is available for me. All I need to do is utilize that relationship. And that, you know, it's like with my son, when he was, you know, 15 months old, something like that, I decided that I was going to go out and I was going to buy him one of those little electric scooters, which is something that, you know, I always thought that he should have. He's probably too young to have it, but I was ready to buy it. You know, I go in to buy one of these scooters, and, you know, I go into the store, and there's like six different models. And, you know, there's an Econo model, and there's a, middle of the road model, and there's a deluxe model, and I asked the salesperson, what's this, what's that, how does it work, and that kind of thing, and what boils down for me is that I want the best for my son, so give me the deluxe model. I want the one that, it's got the horn and the rechargeable battery and, all that stuff, because it's for my son and I want the best for him. And I believe that God wants the best for us, and that God wants the best for me. He wants me to have the deluxe model. I just believe that. In my divorce, probably one of the most painful experiences has been the separation between my son and myself. Because, one of the things that I always thought was that, I don't want to be like my dad, I don't want to be like my mom, and, come to find that, I've become everything I've always resented, and that distance between my son and myself, it's been extremely painful, because that relationship is not what I think it should be. And every month, as I drive to Los Angeles, and I go pick up my son from his preschool, and then we go rent a hotel, and we go and we play. And that's one of the things that he's teaching me how to do. That's an image thing. It doesn't look good. It doesn't look cool to play. It doesn't look good to, get out there on the jungle gym and, swing and make a fool of myself. And I've come to believe that the opposite is true. That it's not cool to sit back on the wall with my arms folded thinking I'm well adjusted. I'm learning about intimacy and I'm learning about commitment with my son. Because we go and I pick him up from school and we go and rent a hotel and we run him up in that hotel. He gets a kick out of pressing the button on the elevator, to go up to the room. And we get in there and we play leapfrog from bed to bed. I was down there in Halloween and or the weekend before that, and we carved a pumpkin, and we had pumpkin guts all over the place. It was wonderful. It was wonderful. And that's a gift from this fellowship. That's a gift that Narcotics Anonymous has given me, is to be present and available. Once again, by all rights, I shouldn't be there. During this process of divorce I was going through all these changes and I want this and that and da 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 da. And I was talking to a friend of mine and he said, you know what, you already got it made. The relationship's already on the books. You just need to get out of the way. And I proceeded to tell him that he didn't understand my situation and my feelings and all of that shit. I call my first sponsor who lives in Los Angeles and I talk to him about it, and he tells me, you know what, the relationship's already on the books, all you need to do is let it go and get out of the way. I go to the World Convention in Florida, I'm listening to the main speaker who's talking about, you know what, all I needed to do was let go, the relationship was already on the books, I just needed to get out of the way. So I guess I need to let go and get out of the way, huh? And I believe that I've done that. And that relationship is what it's supposed to be right now. By all rights, I shouldn't even have it. By all rights, I shouldn't even be here. It's like this intimacy thing and this commitment thing is that it's not all about me. And it's not all about what I want. It's about, doing this thing together. And it's about, throwing aside what I want because I'm choosing to. Not because it's demanded of me. And even if it is demanded of me, I'm choosing to anyway. And it's a beautiful thing. And again, I was talking to somebody before the meeting and you know, we were talking about defects of character, and I've got defects that I don't want to let go of yet. And I laugh when I take an objective look. You know, it's like, what? And give up all this? You know? I am really, really grateful to Narcotics Anonymous. And I want to plug service. Service is a beautiful thing, and a way that we can give back. You know, whether we're whether we're making coffee or selling raffle tickets or doing a 12-step call or in a committee, talking about whatever it is we're working on at the time. It's really a beautiful thing to be able to, again, it's a privilege. I really should be dead. I really shouldn't be here. God has graced us, with this thing called Narcotics Anonymous. And I want to thank the King's Tulare Area Service Committee for asking me to come down here. And lastly, I'd like to ask you, ask myself too, that I'd like to thank Rick Haas for all of his dedicated and grateful service to Narcotics Anonymous. Thank you for letting me share.